Okay, welcome everybody. Tonight's a special edition of our Parsha class on Tuesday nights. We are blessed to have Rabbi Bernie Fox, who was, as I sent out of my email and my WhatsApp, was my Rebbe back in, started I think 19, my first year, I'm going to say 1982. So that's a few years ago, coming up on 40 years. And we have stayed connected. And last year, you guys, he came to teach. And apparently, you guys did a decent job that he's willing to come back. So you get some partial credit as well. And you didn't have to twist his arm that much to come back. So without further ado, I'm going to turn over this year to Rabbi Fox. The title of the class is The Problem with Yaakov's Strategy. So welcome, Scott. Rabbi Fox is giving a shiur from Seattle, Washington, and we have Philadelphia. We got Florida. We got Upper West Side, Upper East Side. We got everybody.
Yeah, Mendel.
And we got Great Neck to toss it in. So without further ado,
one of the OG Tuesday people.
That's it. All right, Rabbi Fox, b'vakasha.
Hey, what's up?
All right. Well, thank you very much for your introduction, and yes, it is a pleasure to be back with you. And I have very much enjoyed working with you in the past and look forward to working with you this evening. So we're going to go through a large number of passages today, but our focus is going to be really on just one portion of these. We need to have context to be able to focus on that portion. So let me just say as an introduction that there are in the Torah two sections that deal with the relationship between Esav and his brother Yaakov. The first section was a few weeks ago, and it was 2 weeks ago in Parshat Toldos. And in that parasha, the basic structure of the relationship between Yaakov and Esav is established. However, this is the first time since then that they're encountering each other, and now they need to work within that structure. So if you remember back in Parshas Toldos, Yaakov walked away with all the blessings, and Esav walked away with much less than what he had, well, let's put it this way, not happy with the way things resolved themselves. So he, certainly Yaakov received the blessings, identified him as really being the upper son in this relationship, and Esav being the junior partner, if any type of partner whatsoever. And Esav was unhappy with that resolution, with the way in which things worked out, despite the fact that he initially acquiesced to it when he sold his rights as a firstborn to Yaakov. But he ultimately had conflict and he had regrets about the deal that he had made. But Yaakov left his father's home. He went to Padan Aram, he went to Haran. They were separated for over 20 years. And now here we go. They're first encountering themselves within this relationship. The relationship has already been established. But now they're going to first encounter themselves with the relationship already established. So they were, before in Parshas Toldos, they were working through and establishing the relationship, but now that's done. And here they are, they've encountered each other, and the relationship has already been set. Okay, so let's start looking at the passages, and we'll go through them. I'll make a couple comments as we go along. As I said, I'm really interested just in a particular section of these. Okay, who wants to get us started? Well, come on, let's not be shy here.
Shana, start us off, Shana.
Yaakov sent angels ahead of him
to his brother Esav
to the land of Seir, the field of Edom. And he commanded them, saying, "So shall you say to my master, to Esav, thus said your servant Yaakov, I have sojourned with Laban, and I have tarried until now. And I have acquired oxen and donkeys, flocks, manservants, and maidservants. And I have sent to tell this to my master to find favor in your eyes."
Keep going, finish it off.
"The angels returned to Yaakov, saying, 'We came to your brother, to Esav, and he is also coming toward you, and 400 men are with him.'"
Okay, so what happened over here? This is the first section of this account, this first part of the episode. What happened? What took place? Summarize for me. By summarizing it, you integrated, you internalize it. What happened? What's the main idea?
I'm gonna start calling on some people. All right, Adrian. Summarize. What was the summary? That's it, babe. This is an active shear.
You had to pick the guy that was eating. He's it's kind of, it's not a bribe. It kind of sounds like it.
He hasn't sent him anything yet. He's just sent messengers to his brother. In this translation, right, they are called angels, but that's a loose, the literal meaning is he sent messengers.
It's like he's showing penitence that he worked really hard and he earned his living, and as opposed to stealing it as he did before. And so I think it's like a twofold message. One is, look, I come bearing gifts. I have riches. That's not going to work. But there seems to be a second underlying message, which is I'm a different person now. I work for what I have, and I'm no longer stealing and cheating.
Okay, that I want you to step back from interpreting why he's saying what he's saying. Okay, so I just want to focus on what he actually said. So what is he, we'll get to the why he's saying these things next, but let's step back from the why and just basically skip that away and just deal with the what. What did he say? So he said, I've been away for a long time, and what?
I've become very rich.
He got rich.
I've become very wealthy. Okay, so I have become wealthy. So he's acknowledging that he's become very wealthy. He's telling Esav, you know, when we meet, you're going to see that I've accumulated a lot of wealth. But what else does he say?
He wants to find favor in Esau's eyes.
Right. I want to find favor in your eyes. In other words, I know that we didn't depart on the best of terms. You were angry with me. I want to put that behind us. Okay, so now let's get to the why. So just in those two statements, Yaakov is grappling with, he's trying to resolve, he's going to encounter Esav, and he's worried about the relationship. He's worried about how Esav is going to react. What is he specifically concerned about? What is he worried? What's he worried about Esav? What does he think might happen, and why?
He thinks he might kill him because he stole things from him.
Well, he didn't say a word about that. What is he saying?
He's basically, it's a deterrent statement saying, hey, I know you're well armed, so am I. So it sounds to me like he might be trying to scare him away by telling him I'm also well armed.
He's not saying, the only thing he is saying is that I know we parted from each other and you were angry. Why were you angry? Yaakov understood that Esav was angry. Angry over what? What was Esav angry about? Excuse me?
He took his birthright.
Right, he got the blessings. Okay, so now he knows that Esav is angry about that, and he's going to now meet Esav, and Esav's anger about the birthright is likely to be incited when they encounter each other. Why? Not just because he's seeing Yaakov, but what else is he going to see?
Well,
a lot of wealth.
So not only is he going to be encountering Yaakov over again, who has this birthright that he resents him having, but he's also going to see all this wealth that he has that he has acquired, and that's going to incite him even more, because it'd be one thing if Yaakov came back a broken, poor, like forlorn, he's not. He's coming back as a very wealthy person. So Yaakov has a problem here. His problem is, how do I win over Esav when we're going to meet? And he's going to see all this, he's going to just be so provoked. So he, first of all, acknowledges the wealth. Okay, it is not, no point in denying it. He acknowledges it. But he's going to have to overcome that. He's going to have to overcome Esav's response to the wealth. I mean, he knows that that's provocative. And he makes the point, I want to put the past behind us. I want to find favor in your eyes. Okay, so that's the first, those are the preliminary steps. Okay. And so the way that ends is that the messengers come back and they say Esav is coming and he's accompanied by 400 men. Right? Which doesn't sound like he's coming out of love. Okay, so let's see what happens next. So now at this point, Yaakov, he's looking at a crisis. So he has to respond. So what happens next? Okay. So let's continue. Let's look at the second set of psukim.
All right. Let me call upon Julie. You want to read, Julie?
Sure. Yaakov became very frightened and was distressed. So he divided the people who were with him and the flocks and the cattle and the camels into two camps. And he said, if Esav comes to one camp and strikes it down, the remaining camp will escape. And Yaakov said, O God of my father Abraham and God of my father Isaac, the Lord who said to me, return to your land and to your birthplace, and I will do good to you. I have become small from all the kindnesses and from all the truth, and you have rendered your servant. For with my staff I crossed this Jordan, and now I have become two camps. Now deliver me from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esav, for I am afraid of him, lest he come and strike me and strike a mother with a child, with children. And you said, I will surely do good with you, and I will make your seed as numerous as the sand of the sea, which cannot be counted because of multitude. So he lodged there on that night, and he took from what came into his hand a gift for his brother Esav, 200 she-goats and 20 he-goats, 200 ewes and 20 rams, 30 nursing camels with their young, 40 cows and 10 bulls, 20 she-donkeys and 10 he-donkeys. And he gave into the hands of his servants each herd individually. And he said to his servants, pass on ahead of me and make a space between one herd and another herd. And he commanded the first one, saying, when my brother Esav meets you and asks you, saying, to whom do you belong and where are you going and from whom are these before you? You shall say, I belong to your servant Yaakov. It is a gift to my master, to Esav, and behold, he himself is behind us. And he commanded also the second one, also the third one, also all those who followed the herd, saying, in this manner shall you speak to Esav when you meet him. And you shall say, and also behold, your servant Yaakov is behind us. For he said, I will appease his anger with the gift that is going before me, and afterwards I will see his face, perhaps he will favor me. So the gift passed on before him, and he lodged that night in the camp.
Okay, so again, what happens? Again, he's faced with a crisis. Esav is coming. He has 400 men with him. Not a harbinger. It's not news that suggests that he's coming in love. So what is his response?
Mendel, what's Yaakov's response? Yeah, I'm just calling people tonight. Everybody got to be on their toes tonight. That's it. Showtime at the Apollo.
That's all right. It seems like he panics and tries to – I mean, he doesn't completely panic, but he's afraid. And he decides to divide his camp and thinking that, you know, at least some people will escape alive.
Right. That's step number one. So step number one is that he divides his camp in half. So you're correct. Rashi says exactly what you said, because his calculation is that if he divides them in half and he separates them a distance from one another, so when Esav comes with 400 men, he's going to have to make a decision about which one of these camps he wants to attack, which will give the other one the opportunity to flee. So he's preparing for disaster. Okay, that's first part. What else does he do? What else?
Well, could you scroll down on the sheet a little bit?
Say what?
Can you scroll down on the sheet a little bit?
Oh, yeah, sure. So we've got the two camps. So now we're up to, and Yaakov said, oh, God of my father Abraham. We're up to this part. What's he doing here?
He does a tefillah.
So he's praying. Now, this prayer in itself deserves a class, but that's not our purpose tonight. But let's just leave it at that. Okay, it's a complex, it's not a simple prayer to understand, but he presents a prayer to God, asking that God save him from Esav. I can refer you to some interesting comments on it. If you're interested, just take a note, Chovos Levavos, the third shiur, the sixth chapter. You'll find a discussion of, an interesting discussion of Yaakov's comments. So again, it's the Chovos Levavos, it's the third shiur, so Shar Avodas Hashem, and it's the sixth chapter. So he makes reference to this prayer. Okay, so he has some interesting comments about it that are, they're worth looking at. Okay, next. So that's the second step. So that takes us all the way down to the end of the prayer, right? He says, so deliver me, right? And then what does he do? Then what does he do? So after the prayer, what's he do?
Matthew, what does he do next?
I'm not sure.
Okay, what's the next thing he does? Okay, so he lodged there that night, and he took from what came to his hand a gift for his brother Asa. What is he doing?
All right, Scott.
He's like preparing to meet his brother, so to like kind of give him this gift to kind of like calm him down as opposed to fighting him.
Okay, so this gift, okay, look at it. What's your impressions of this gift?
It seems like a good gift, like a big gift. He's trying to make up for what he did.
It's big. As a matter of fact, look at the detail that the Chumash provides. About this gift. What's the Chumash trying to communicate in this detail?
That
it gets better and better and better.
Yeah, it's massive. It's a massive gift. And he even tells his messengers who are delivering the gift not to deliver it all at once, but to spread it out so that, the first group of animals arrives and Esav thinks, wow, what a wonderful gift. But he's no sooner accepting the first group of animals, then wow, the second one is over the horizon. And then he accepts the second one, and wow, this is even more fantastic. And then the third comes over the horizon. But I want to just speculate about something. Okay, I want to just acknowledge this is a speculation, but I suspect that this gift was, although Yaakov was very wealthy when he was returning and he was meeting with Esav, this was a significant gift even for him. It was not a token. And we'll see later on the evidence of that. It's not a small gift. It's not a token. It's not something that you give to somebody. When I say a token, you give it to somebody to show respect or to show appreciation. No, this was a gift where Yaakov was really giving something, a significant portion of his wealth, to Esav. Okay, something that was, that's the kind of gift, when I was head of school, so there's an expression that we use that was used in development, which is called the ouch factor. The ouch factor is, how much can you ask a donor or a contributor to give you before it starts to hurt? And when it starts to hurt, how do you get past that? So, when you're like, for example, doing a capital campaign, so, and you're going to go to a major donor to give, let's say, for example, $100,000. So you know, it's that's not small. That's not chump change. You're asking for a big amount of money. I mean, there's lots of things that a person could do with $100,000. So when you ask him to give that, there's an ouch factor. So how do you persuade the person to do that? That's this is a gift that has an ouch factor. So he's giving him a gift large enough that when Esav receives it, he's going to realize this is not something that is just a token. This is something where Yaakov is really, really giving of himself. Okay, so that's the second, so that's the next part. And now we come up to a mysterious set of psukim. I'm not even going to ask you what they mean. Let's just read through them quickly. And he rose during the night, and he took his two eyes and his two maidservants and his 11 children, and he crossed the ford of the Yabok. So he crossed the Jordan River at the Yabok ford. And he took them and brought them across the stream, and he took across what was his. So what these are doing here and what they're about, it's not clear. Okay, so we will come back to these psukim later on. Now we get to the next major part of this story. Okay, so Yaakov has transferred his family to the other side of the Jordan, and now what happens? Okay, who wants to read?
Let me, Matthew, you want to read?
Sure. And Yaakov was left alone, and a man wrestled with him under the bolt of dawn. When he saw that he could not prevail against him, he touched the socket of his hip, and the socket of Yaakov's hip became dislocated as he wrestled with him. And he, the angel, said, "Let me go, for dawn is breaking." But he, Yaakov, said, "I will not let you go unless you have blessed me." So he said to him, "What is your name?" And he said, "Yaakov." And he said, "Your name shall no longer be called Yaakov, but Israel, because you have commanding power with an angel of God and with men, and you have prevailed." And Yaakov asked and said, "Now tell me your name." And he said, "Why is it that you ask for my name?" And he blessed him there. And Yaakov named the place Peniel, for he said, "I saw an angel face to face, and my soul was saved." And the sun rose for him when he passed Peniel, and he was limping on his thigh. Therefore, the children of Israel may not eat the displaced tendon, which is on the socket of the hip, until this day, for he touched the socket of Yaakov's hip in the hip groove. Let's say.
What happened? So what happened here? So Yaakov's alone, and what happens?
A thousand different interpretations.
But let's just stick to what can we say that's not going to be subject to interpretation?
That he wrestled a being.
Okay, so he had an encounter with this being, and they had quite a tussle, right? And ultimately, what happened?
Ultimately, he prevailed because the angel said, "Let me go."
Yeah, he said, "Uncle." Okay.
Is this story also referred to in the Sefer HaChinuch? Because there's a part in that where they talk about that we're not allowed to eat a certain tendon because of the fight with Yaakov, but that may be different.
Yes, correct.
It's filet mignon, right?
It's the third mitzvah. It's the third mitzvah in Sefer HaChinuch, and he refers to this tussle, representing a basic idea, and he explains that we memorialize that idea by not eating this sinew, the gidanasha. Correct. Very good. Excellent.
Rabbi, just textually, you know, reading this, I don't know if maybe it's a mistranslation or lost in translation, but why would the angel touch, dislocate his hip? And then say, "Let me go." Wouldn't the fact that he dislocated his hip mean that the angel was able to go because now Yaakov was injured?
So that's
why is it structured that way?
Good question. But I don't want to answer it right now. Let it just suffice to say that, you know, in this battle between Esav and this being, Yaakov between Yaakov and this being, Yaakov ultimately triumphs, but not without being hurt. So in other words, he pays a price for his victory. Okay, so if you could look at Sefer Chinuch afterwards, you could find it on Sefaria, and it's the third mitzvah, and he has a very good explanation. Okay, so I don't want to get into that right now.
Is this like a forced blessing? Does it still count if it's forced?
Hold on. Okay, so the only thing I want to add here is that this encounter. So the Rambam explains, and many Mefarshim agree, this was a vision that Yaakov had. So there was no real man, and angels aren't human beings, and so he wasn't really. But he had this vision, and that this angel is Sarah, shall I say, represents Esav. So what's happening if we insert that into what we just read? So let's just insert that. So he's having a vision, and what's happening in that vision?
He's having a nightmare.
What's happening in that nightmare?
He's ruminating. Good. His brain is ruminating about what's going to come.
Okay, but what? So it's incited by the anxiety that he feels, but in this nightmare, how do things actually work out?
He wins.
He takes a beating, but in the end, he does triumph. He does triumph over. He survives. Now, what's interesting is that even though this was a vision, so he has a physical response to it, that when he comes out of the vision, he's limping. So it was such a strong vision that it left a physical impression upon him. And so he had, you might say, it could have been a psychosomatic symptom, or it could have been that in his tossing in this nightmare, he actually damaged himself. But one way or the other, it was very intense. It was so intense that it left an outcome, a physical outcome, when the vision was over. So what's interesting here, and this is what I really want to focus on, is that he's having this vision, and it's apparently some sort of message, but it is not presented as a prophecy. The Torah does not present it as a prophecy. You know, when we read about the prophecies of Avraham or Yitzchak, of Moshe, well, Moshe might be an exception, but generally we read about prophecies. So, you know, up until, you know, so the Torah, especially when it's talking about the patriarchs, it just tells us the prophecy. If it was communicated through a parable, the Torah is rarely interested in explaining what the parable was and telling us the parable. When it does, there's a reason. There's one other case where it happens. Where is a vision presented as a parable? It's one other case. Where is a prophecy? Where does the Torah describe the actual vision that the prophet had when he received the prophecy?
The Bris Ben Abisarim?
Say what?
The Bris Ben Abisarim?
Okay, partially. Part of that was definitely a vision. Tardima Nafla Amafram, that's correct. But the one that's more entirely fits this description is the beginning of Parshas Vayera, when Avraham has the vision of these three men that come, and he has this whole interaction with them, and then he's, you know, there's a whole complex extended vision that Avraham has, and the Torah there prefers for us to know the vision other than just the straight prophecy, other than the message it contains. So it tells us the message, it does, but it tells us the message within the context of the vision. So here also, the Torah is very interested in us knowing the vision and knowing how intense that vision was. And so I'd like to understand why that is, why that was, what the Torah is trying to get at by telling us that not just the message that Yaakov was receiving, but the vision he received and its intensity. Let's see what happens next. And so now let's go. Again, these are the psukim I wanted to focus on, the ones that we just did. But now we're up to the actual encounter. Okay, so what happens next? Okay, so let's go look at this set of psukim. These are the final set of passages. Go ahead.
All right, Shana.
Yaakov lifted his eyes and saw, and behold, Esav was coming, and with him were 400 men. So he divided the children with Leah and with Rachel and with the two maidservants. And he placed the maidservants and their children first, and Leah and her children after, and Rachel and her Joseph last. And he went ahead of them and prostrated himself to the ground 7 times until he came close to his brother. And Esav ran toward him and embraced him. And he fell on his neck and kissed him, and they wept. And he lifted his eyes and saw the women and the children. And he said, "Who are these to you?" And he said, "The children with whom God has favored your servant." And the maidservants and their children drew near and prostrated themselves. And Leah and her children drew near and prostrated themselves. And after them, Yosef and Rachel drew near and prostrated themselves. And he said, "What is to you the purpose of all this camp that I have met?" And he said, "To find favor in my master's eyes." But Esav said, "I have plenty, my brother. Let what you have remain yours." Thereupon Yaakov said, "Please, no. If indeed I have found favor in your eyes, then you shall take my gift from my hand, because I have seen your face, which is like seeing the face of an angel, and you have accepted me. Now take my gift, which has been brought to you, for Hashem has..." Where are we? You were
just... "Now take my gift, which has been brought to you, for God has favored me."
"Wait, and because I have everything, he prevailed upon him and he took it. Thereupon he said, 'Travel and we will go, and I will go alongside you.' And he said to him, 'My master knows that the children are tender, and the flocks and the cattle, which are raising their young, depend on me. And if they overdrive them one day, all the flocks will die. Now let my master go ahead before his servant, and I will move at my own slow pace, according to the pace of the work that is before me, and according to the pace of the children, until I come to my master, to Seir.' Thereupon Esav said, 'Let me leave with you some of the people who are with me.' But he said, 'Why do that? May I find favor in my master's eyes.' So Esav returned on that day on his way to Seir."
Okay, what happened? So here they finally encounter one another. Okay, and what happens?
Yaakov was seeking acceptance, and it seems that he got it after he gave him the gifts.
How did he succeed? What did he do to succeed? What happened? The passage is telling you exactly what the mechanism was, how it succeeded. They encounter each other. He bows 7 times. What's he doing?
Showing respect.
Showing more than respect. He's showing subservience. Not just showing respect. He's showing subservience.
Right.
So he prostrates himself. He bows 7 times before he even approaches him. Okay, then Esav is introduced to the entire mishpacha. Okay, fine. Who also demonstrate their subservience. And then what happens? "What is to you the purpose of all this camp that I have met?" And he said, "To find favor in my master's eye." But Esav said, "I have plenty, my brother. Let what you have remain yours." What is Esav saying?
He's turning down the gift, saying...
Why? Why is he turning it down?
Because I have plenty. He has his own wealth and riches and his own enormity, if you will.
So I would say, you go to somebody's house, right? And you're invited for dinner, so maybe you bring a bottle of wine. If the host would say to you, "You know, you keep your bottle of wine," how would you feel?
That it's not good enough.
Right, you'd be insulted, right? The host wouldn't say that because he doesn't want to insult you. What would be the scenario in which the host might say something like that?
Well, he doesn't want to feel guilty because he's going to kill you.
Okay, but assuming that's not true. Assuming that you weren't that, didn't make that bad a decision and agreeing to go to dinner there.
If you bought a bottle of wine that you clearly cannot afford.
Right, exactly. So you might say, "You know, it wasn't necessary. You can't afford that. Take it back, return it. You know, you don't need to give me a gift like that." Okay, so the Esav response to this gift was a reaction to its enormity, to the fact that this gift was just way over the top, and it's something that, like I mentioned earlier, it seems to be not the type of gift that's just a token. It's not just a bottle of wine. It's the most expensive bottle of wine in the store. Okay, so Esav says, no, you know, I don't need this, and why are you sharing your wealth with me? So what is, no, listen to Yaakov's answer. What is his response? His answer is brilliant. What does he say? Please know, okay? If I indeed have found favor in your eyes, then you shall take my gift from my hand, because I have seen your face, which is like seeing the face of an angel, and you have accepted me.
It's very pure, like seeing Yaakov act this way. It's.
But what is he saying? Let's not judge it. What is he saying? What's his point?
The point is, just your mere presence is so important to me.
The what?
That it's worth all the wealth in the world, because seeing you is like seeing God.
Like, he's saying that basically, I'm going to say it a little differently. Basically, what he's saying is that if you accept this gift, you're doing me a favor. Right? It's an honor for me to be able to give you this gift. So if you accept this gift, you're honoring me. In other words, you're right. The gift is an enormous gift, and it's not one I would be giving you just as a token. You accept this gift because, look, let's say you're going to see somebody. You're going to visit Israel. You have a meeting with the prime minister. Okay, so you're going to meet Bennett. So you take along, you know, some sort of gift that you're going to give him, and he takes that gift and he says, "Wow, this is so wonderful." And he puts it on the shelf in his office. How are you going to feel? What is he communicating to you when he puts it on the shelf in his office?
That it's a place of honor and that he appreciates
it. Right, he's right. He's saying, so Yaakov is saying that to Esav, if you accept this gift, you're honoring me. You're honoring me. Because, wow, I gave Esav a gift and he accepted it. Now, if it's just a token, but if you take this large gift from me, you're saying, well, it's just a large gift, but I'm giving you such a large gift because it's an honor for me to give you a gift that you will accept. Okay, so now let's go back to the very beginning. When Yaakov was thinking about encountering Esav, what was he worried about? He was worried about, A, that Esav's going to be angry about the way things were resolved in Parshas Toldos with Yaakov getting the blessings and being the senior partner, the upper partner, the managing partner in this relationship. And the second thing is that he was worried about is that the wealth is going to incite Esav even more. So Yaakov had to create a strategy to overcome those two issues, to overcome the two things that he thought were going to get in the way of him encouraging Esav to look beyond the past.
Meaning it couldn't be too much or too little?
So first of all, what did he have to demonstrate? What did he have to do?
Well, a certain level of obsequiousness to it.
Right. So first thing he had to do was he had to demonstrate, he had to communicate subservience. That was the first step. Okay, and what was the second step? How was he going to overcome the issue of the wealth?
By giving it to him.
He's going to say that this wealth is not as significant to me, as you accepting me as your servant. Now I have all this wealth, but it doesn't mean anything to me because I'm willing to give all this stuff to you. Because the wealth is not worth as much to me as having you as my older brother, as my senior brother. So he executed the strategy to address the issues that were going to incite Esav against him. He was subservient to Esav. He did not lord over him. On the contrary, he conducted himself as somebody who was the junior brother, which is what Esav wanted. And the other thing he did was that he addressed the issue of the wealth. He couldn't hide the wealth. He couldn't deceive Esav. He had all this wealth, but what he did was that he minimized its significance. He said, "This wealth is not as important as having you as my older brother. So I'm willing to give up a whole bunch of my wealth. You know, it'll be an honor for you to accept it." So he addressed both of the issues. So he had a plan, and he executed it, and it was successful. At the end of the day, Esav was very pleased with Yaakov's behavior, and he embraced him, he loved him, he wanted to accompany him, Yaakov was smart enough to realize that these attitudes could change, so he did not encourage Esav to stay around, but you know, he got this initial encounter worked out very well. Okay, so now what I want you to think about is what is the significance of the vision? How did the vision impact this? Did it have any impact on Yaakov? Did it change anything? Do you notice anything that changed from Yaakov's plan before the vision to after the vision? Was there anything that changed?
Before the vision, he had separated all the children and women, and this section begins with that they're all together.
Right, correct. What was, now this is why I need you to project yourself into the story. Okay, so if you're in the story, if you're Yaakov, in that first set of passages, when Yaakov is thinking about his encounter with Esav, so that first set, how's Yaakov feeling?
How's Yaakov feeling
when they come back and they tell him Esav's coming with 400 men? And what's the impression you get? How do you imagine what was Yaakov's state of mind as he was developing his plan? He divided his camp into two separate sections, put them a distance away from each other. He turns to Hashem in prayer. He prepares this gift. What's his state of mind?
I'm nervous.
He's anxious. He's very anxious. Okay, because he doesn't know how things are going to work out. He hopes that he will be able to win over Esav, but he's prepared for the possibility that he won't. So he's very insecure. He's not sure how this is all going to work. After the dream?
I mean, he seems a little bit more confident. He has some sort of confidence.
After the dream, there's no two camps. After the dream, he's brought everybody back together. He knows he's got a solid plan, and he's confident in his wisdom that it will work out.
He went into the offensive.
Well, he what?
He went into the offensive. He created a game plan.
In the sense that he put himself, in the sense that he now put himself 100% behind the plan.
And he created a plan.
He's not thinking about, he's committed. He's 100% committed. He's no longer thinking about, well, what happens if the plan doesn't work? He's committed to this plan. And really, does that make a difference? Does it make a difference? Did that change? Did that have potential impact on the way things worked out? What do you think?
So.
Why? What would have happened if he had not gotten behind the plan 100%? So Esav comes, and he's gotten this great gift. But what is he going to see when he arrives?
That either Yaakov is there, or he's not there.
He's going to see these two camps, right?
Right.
And what's he going to be thinking?
This guy is
hiding something,
not being straight with me.
Well, he's going to think that he's afraid of me. He's not confident that I'm going to that I'm going to forgive him, that I'm going to put the past behind us. He's worried I'm going to attack him. What happens when you tell a bully that you're afraid of him?
They leave you alone.
When you tell a bully you're afraid, he leaves you alone?
No.
When you tell a bully that you're afraid of him, you give him all the encouragement he needs to abuse you. So Yaakov's plan really, really was aided by the fact that he was able to get 100% behind it. As you said earlier, he had confidence. He's being aggressive in the sense that he's all in now. So when Esav comes, you know, it comes across as completely sincere, communicates absolute sincerity, and Yaakov believes firmly that this gift is going to mend the relationship between them, that he's going to really settle the dispute between them. He's going to demonstrate to Esav that he accepts him as being senior to him, and he's going to demonstrate how important that is to him, and Esav is going to get every impression that this is sincere. But if Esav arrives in the camp to split up, he's going to know right away that Yaakov's not sure it's going to work. He's not sure that Esav's going to forgive him. And he's dealing with a very scared person. And that's not going to encourage him to embrace him. So what was it about that dream that gave him confidence? Very simple. What gave him confidence in that dream? What was it about that dream that changed his attitude? What did he see? What happened in the dream? He did battle with
the angel.
The angel represents Esav. And what happened?
He defeated him.
And it was a very, very strong experience because when it was over, he was limping. It was intense. So it was very real to him. By the time he met Esav the next day, he had already, in his imagination, experienced the entire event. He was just playing out what he'd already experienced in his vision. So he turned to God in fear, in anxiety. But the response was he had that vision. And when he had that vision, he knew how things were going to come out. So when he encountered Esav the next day, he wasn't afraid anymore. He was completely confident because in that vision, he already experienced the encounter. All that's happening now is that he's re-experiencing it. He's already re-experiencing something that he already went through the night before. So he does it with complete confidence. He doesn't need to split the camp up, not necessary. He knows it's going to work. He knows that his prayers were received. That was the message of the vision, and it's going to be effective. So he's not worried.
Well, when you say re-experience, Rabbi, the experience that he had was battle. That wasn't the experience that he had in reality. He experienced wrestling and fighting.
Right.
So you're saying that he came in with the expectation that there was going to be a fight and he was going to win after that fight?
No, I'm saying that in that vision, okay, he saw himself confronting Esav. Yes, the parable of the vision was a fight. But the message of it was that in his engagement with Esav, he will struggle with him. There's going to be struggle, but in the end, he will triumph. So it doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to be a physical struggle. There's no physical struggle when he encountered Esav the next day. But it was a struggle. He was engaged in a struggle in which Esav enters into the encounter with a set of pre-existing attitudes, and he has to engage and overcome those attitudes. There's a battle going on. It's a psychological battle. They're not physically tussling with each other, but there is a psychological dynamic in which they are battling with each other, Esav enters it with some very strong feelings, but Yaakov manages to grab hold of him and to be able to overcome those feelings. So the battle, there's a parable, which is a physical battle, but it represents a psychological interplay in which Yaakov was able to triumph. So the title of this discussion tonight was The Problem with the Strategy. The problem with the strategy is that in order for it to work, what was necessary? What did Yaakov not have when he put the strategy together?
Sincerity, commitment, confidence.
He didn't have the confidence. It ultimately only worked because in that vision, he gained the confidence that he needed to execute it effectively.
But what was the insight he gained in the Nevuah?
Because in that Nevuah, before he had the Nevuah, right, he prayed to Hashem. And before he prayed to Hashem, he was in a state of anxiety. So there were three steps. He was in a state of anxiety because Esav's coming with his 400 men. He prepared a strategy in response, but he's still in anxiety. He's still anxious. He's not confident it's going to work. He's okay. Turned to Hashem, and he's prayed for Hashem to help him, to help him be effective, that this strategy should work out. I mean, just as an aside, he didn't pray to Hashem to make Esav just go away. He knew that he was going to have to, take action. He was going to have to be the one that puts a plan in place. He's praying to Hashem that the plan should be effective.
Okay.
Okay, so, but he's not confident. Even after he says the prayer, he hasn't katonti him. He says, I don't know. I don't know whether or not, he expresses his fear. I don't know whether or not Hashem is going to respond. God has done so much for me. Can I expect that he's going to do this also? I don't know. So he's not 100% confident. And then he gets his response. The response is the vision. And in that vision, Hashem is telling Yaakov, Avinu is telling Yaakov that I'm with you. You're going to be engaged in a struggle tomorrow, a psychological struggle with Esav, but you will be the one. You will be the one that will triumph. You will be the one. Your plan will work. You will succeed. So now the ingredient that was missing was the confidence in the plan that's been put in place because of the vision. So the next day when he actually encounters Esav, it's just the playing out of the vision. Remember, the vision was so intense that he actually had a physical effect on him. So it transformed his attitude. He sees things differently. He's a different person. He's confident tomorrow, the next day when he sees Esav. He doesn't need to split his camp up. He doesn't need to demonstrate fear because he's not afraid. There's no fear for Esav to observe.
Rabbi, I hear the lesson, but I find it somewhat contradictory to other lessons. The Talmud says that a person who's too confident in his plans or that his prayers will be heard, God makes him, judges him with closer scrutiny.
Exactly. He was not confident. After he prayed,
it's only after he had the vision
that he knew that the Shem had responded to his prayers.
But what's the takeaway here? Is the takeaway, be confident, God is going to deliver you, which the Talmud says that makes God judge you even more harshly, or is the takeaway? What's the takeaway here?
Okay, I just again want to respond to that point one more time. He was not confident that God was going to accept his prayers. He didn't know. It was only at the vision was Hashem's response. Only after he had the vision did he have confidence.
So when should we get? I mean, we don't have visions.
That's right. You don't. So you really can't be confident. I mean, I hope not. So really, we can't be confident. We don't have a basis for that confidence. We could turn to Hashem, but we don't have that privilege of receiving visions and knowing that our prayers have been accepted. So we really don't know. We need to just do our best, and we need to hope that our prayers have been accepted. But in Yaakov's case, he was enough, and he was granted the vision. But I think that I want to talk about the issue of what the takeaway is. Okay. What is the Chumash doing here when it tells us all this? What is it doing? Why do we need to know all this?
Because Yaakov was always slight-handed. He always did things in a crooked way, in a dishonest way. Here he's being straightforward. I think that there's a communication there about when you're honest and sincere about something.
Okay, go ahead. Anybody else?
I mean, even in families, there are people that, in modern day, there are people that do not speak for years and years. So it could be an example of, how to deal with a difficult situation. And sometimes mm-hmm. almost, maybe, I don't want to say being subservient.
Putting your ego on the shelf.
Yeah.
Right. Definitely true. That's an important takeaway. What else? Okay, let me ask you a question. I want you to think about this. Which one? Now you've learned, you've been learning with, for years. You've learned, Chumash. You've been through these parashiyos many, many times. Tell me something. Which one of the Avos do you feel? Which one of the patriarchs do you feel most familiar with? Yitzhak. What about Yitzhak? Who feels most familiar with Yitzhak? You know what? You don't know anything about Yitzhak. You know why you don't know anything about Yitzhak? Because the Torah doesn't tell anything about Yitzhak. The Torah tells you barely anything about Yitzhak. Okay? What about Avraham?
You know more, but the Torah really spends the most time speaking about Yaakov.
Yeah. But not only that, but Yaakov is the only one whose personality is revealed. He's the only one that the Torah actually reveals his personality. You don't know Avram's personality. You know nothing about it. You know his wisdom. You know all the smart things he did. You know about his bravery. You don't know. If I ask you, what were Avram's internal fears? What were, you would have no idea. You have no way of knowing. The only one of the Avos that you could actually imagine, you could actually have an image of, is Yaakov Avinu, based on the Chumash. If you go through Chazal, so you can, I think you can develop, an image of the other Avos. But based on the Chumash itself, impossible. The Chumash wants you to know Yaakov. The Chumash wants you to know the person from whom you came. Yaakov is the Av from which we all descend. Avraham had other children, Yitzhak had other children. He had Yaakov and Esav, but Yaakov, all Bnei Yisrael comes from Yaakov. We are Bnei Yisrael. That's who we are. We're not. We don't call ourselves Bnei Avraham. We don't call ourselves Bnei Yitzhak. We call ourselves Bnei Yisrael. Bnei Yaakov. Beis Yaakov. That's who we are. And so Torah wants us to know Yaakov. It wants us to be able to not just imagine him, not just intellectualize him, but to actually have an image of who he was, to actually understand who he was and what his greatness was. So I think that might be the reason why the Torah gives so much attention to Yaakov and to his, and this is not the end of it. The Torah is going to continue to delve into Yaakov. Some very important aspects of Yaakov's thinking and his personality are going to become evident later on. But the Torah wants us to understand who he was, because this is our Av, this is our patriarch, this is the one for whom we all descend. That's my just a fear. And I suspect that might be one of them. Good. Any other questions?
So I guess the question is, so practically from this whole episode, being that we're not Nevi'im, and we're not going to be able to know if our tefillos are ever accepted, from a strategic perspective, what is gleaned from here for the regular Jew who's not for who's the non-Yaakov?
I'd rather not, you know, I think that might take me into an eerie, look, let me just put it this way, that when Chazal were preparing for an encounter with Esav, you know, with an encounter with the contemporary Esav, so they look to this parasha to understand the nature of the relationship. Okay, so the Torah here is telling us something about, you know, about the approach, that the psychology of the Esav, and what needs to be, what you need to deal with when you're encountering an Esav. So it's explaining what Yaakov's strategy was. Not necessarily, it's not always going to be, you know, anybody that uses the same strategy, regardless of the circumstances, is a moron. But in other words, but you have to understand, you know, but it does suggest to us, what are the issues that we're dealing with when we're dealing with an Esav? So look, so the Torah is explaining to us that we're going to have to deal with this sense, the resentment they got regarding chosenness. So that was one issue that Yaakov had to deal with. And that's a contemporary issue that Jews have to confront, that, you know, our enemies resent the idea of our claims of chosenness. And the other issue we have to deal with is that that any Jewish success is considered to be a confirmation of that chosenness, and in itself presents a threat. So, you know, we need to think about, you know, how to deal with that. I mean, and I'm not saying that there's one solution. So, for example, you know, Menachem Begin was fond of saying that, you know, the non-Jewish world, something to the effect of, the non-Jewish world may not like the Jewish fighter, but he does have to deal with him. So, like, you know, he's not saying that we should be subservient. He's saying, on the contrary, that we have, you know, we have a capacity to defend ourselves. And, you know, under our current circumstances, we have the capacity to defend ourselves. We shouldn't sell that short. We shouldn't compromise that. So I'm not suggesting that Yaakov's approach to Esav is the one we should always implement. But it is important that we study and understand the wisdom with which the approach he took of analyzing the opponents and understanding what are the motivations, what are the motivations that move this opponent, what makes this opponent tick, and responding to those instead of just, and it's really very hard to do. You know, you can't, again, going back to my experiences as a head of school, you know, when I was dealing with parents who had an issue or were very upset, the most important thing is the listening. Okay, you can't go into a confrontation, you know, with preconceived ideas about what the other person's position is. You have to listen carefully. You have to listen. Sometimes you have to be attentive beyond the actual words being used, and try to understand, you know, where the person is really. I'll give you an example, okay, which just fell into my lap. It was just an interesting encounter. We had an arrangement with another day school that we didn't have bus service, but this other day school did have bus service. And so they made an arrangement with the parents to live in this neighborhood that they would pick them up, they would take them to school every day, and at the end of the day, they would pick them up at school and they would bring them home. So these are not our buses. We don't own the buses. We don't hire the driver. This is all being done by another school. Our only role in this arrangement is that the parents wrote the check out to us and we passed it on to the other school. So we were just the middleman in this relationship. We were just a facilitator, but the relationship was between the parents and between the other school. Okay, fine. Now, inevitably, there were days when we had school and they didn't. So each time one of those days would occur on the calendar, we had to work out in advance. And we did this, we facilitated this, we worked out in advance whether or not there would be bus service that day or not. Now, sometimes there was, because the bus driver worked for the other school full time. He even worked on those days where there was no school. And, he'd be happy to make a couple extra bucks picking the kids up in the neighborhood, taking them to school and bringing them home at the end of the day. So each time one of these calendar conflicts arose, we always made the determination in advance and let the parents know, would there be bus service or would there not be bus service? Okay. So along comes a Monday when we are having school and the other school is not. And we've already spoken about this and we've communicated with the parents on behalf of the other school that there will be bus service that morning, that it's going to take place even though they're not going to be in session. Well, guess what happened?
Bus did not show up.
Okay. So I'm sitting in my office and I've not gotten to class yet. And my door is open and the business manager is on the phone with one of the parents who was absolutely irate. Absolutely irate. And he is, I don't know exactly what he was saying, but it was not pleasant. And the business manager just had no idea even how to respond to him because, we're really caught in the middle. We don't really have, he said to him at least two or three times, I understand you're upset, but, and you really should direct your concerns to the other school. We're not really, we can't suspend the driver. We can't, discipline him in any way. There's nothing we could do. He's not our employee. You're not making the arrangement with us. You're making the arrangement with the other school and he's their employee, not ours. And it didn't do any good. So afterwards, when the phone conversation was over, the business manager, of course, was exasperated. So I said to him, you're not hearing what he's saying. What he told you, if you listen very carefully, I didn't hear the whole thing either, but I know what was going on. What he was saying to the business manager was, I don't give a kihuzeh, okay, who actually is responsible. I pay this money so that I should not be inconvenienced, okay? I have a job in the morning. I need to go to work, and my kids need to be picked up and be taken to school. And I pay this money so that I should not have to be involved, so that I should not have to shuffle them to school, shuttle them, and so I should not have to make this phone call, okay? So I don't care. I don't want to hear about arrangements and technicalities. I gave you the money. You make sure this is now here. So I'd say you're not hearing. Okay. What he is saying to you is that he doesn't care about any of the things you're saying. He doesn't want to be inconvenienced and he's upset because his day was ruined. Okay. That's why he's upset. Okay. Should he be yelling at you? Of course not. Okay. But you're not, when you keep telling him the arrangement is not between us and you, you're missing the point. Okay. That's not an answer. He doesn't care about that. What he's telling you is I gave you the money. I do not want to be inconvenienced. Don't bother me. So what I'm saying is you have to be able to listen and understand what's really going on in the other person's. I knew somebody who was, He was involved in negotiating with a union, so he was a executive for a newspaper and was negotiating with a union. And he told me, he says, when you're negotiating with the union, forget about their demands. Okay, the demands are not what you have to listen to. What you have to listen to is why they're making those demands. You have to figure out what's behind them. He says, because you may not be able to meet the demands, But if you understand why they're making those demands, what's really bothering them, and that's being expressed through those demands, you may discover that you could satisfy. Mm. So they may be asking, let's say, for example, a $2 an hour raise. But is it really because they want the $2 or because they don't feel valued and respected? So you may not have the $2, okay, to give them. Maybe you can't do that. But maybe there are other things you could do. If what they're really concerned about is the way in which they feel they're being treated, maybe there's other things you could do to make them know how valued they are. That was his point. So again, same paradigm here. You know, what Yaakov had the ability to do was to understand Esav, to look into his mind, his psychology, understand where he's coming from, and respond to that, to create a strategy that is that responds to who he's really dealing with. That's all.
Good. Good. All right, Rabbi Yeshakoa, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Thank you. This was really great.
All right, great. We'll get together again at some point.
All right.
Okay. Sounds great.
Always a pleasure, Rabbi. Thank you.
Take care, guys.
All right, guys. Have a great night. Be well.
Thank you.
Bye. Thank you.